Artemis endeavors to get more women
and girls
in the field and on the water.
To support women as leaders in the conservation movement.
To ensure the vitality of our lands, waters, and wildlife.
Artemis endeavors to change the face of conservation.
Hey everybody, this is your host, Marcia Brownlee with the Artemis Podcast. And I'm very excited to talk to you today with two brand new things happening here at the Artemis Podcast. One is that we are outside in the field testing what it's like to have a conversation when we can hear birds in the background, which is going to be delightful. And second, we are having an in-person conversation, which is the first time we've ever done that on the Artemis Podcast. Typically, we do it online, even before the pandemic. So I'm excited, and I'm excited that we are joined for this brand new adventure by Mandela Van Eeden, who is the newest member of the National Wildlife Federation's sporting arm, which is NWF Outdoors. She was hired a month ago, is that right? Yeah, a month ago to be our communications person. And I'm excited to have her on the team, and I'm excited for you all to get to know her. So Mandela, welcome.
It is such a beautiful day. We are not going to tell you exactly where we're sitting, but I will say that there are some amazing red-winged blackbirds that are flying on to some cattails, and the cattails sway back and forth when they land, and it's a beautiful forest full of ponderosa, larch, and Doug fir. The grass is a polychromatic array of green, and it's tick season. I thought I would, you know, maybe wait till the end before I told Marcia so she wasn't sitting here wiping off the potential ticks, but I've already pulled two off. So check yourself, check yourself. That's one of the side effects of recording in the field, but I'm very inspired when I look down into the meadow right now and look at a butterfly flying across. This is where I feel most comfortable, is being outside and sharing stories.
Side tick story. While we're at it, my sister and her family, who are from Ohio, came to visit, and we went on a hike, which is one of my favorite things to do with people who are here from out of town. And my nephew, who's a city boy, 9 years old, lovely individual, does not care for bugs. And found a tick and reacted strongly. And I realized that in my time, I've developed it. I mean, nobody likes them. They're gross, and I feel them crawling in my hair at night sometimes when it's in the spring. But I realized that I've actually come quite accustomed to having them be a part of my outdoor experience. So I don't know what to say, except I won't react that strongly. Should I find one, we'll be good.
Right? Yeah.
Yep. They're just a part of being outside.
Exactly.
Mandela, tell us a little bit about yourself.
So my family is kind of split between rooting deeply in Montana and rooting deeply in Southern Africa. So going back about 400 years, my family's been in South Africa since 1652 on my father's side, and all Afrikaans. And so that's another story in itself, but come from a farming dairy background in South Africa. And my grandmother purchased an area of land on the most southern tip of Africa by working with farmers during the years of apartheid and turned that into a private nature reserve. And that nature reserve is located right at the most southern tip, right on the Indian Ocean. So if you were to look at a map of the continent of Africa and you were to walk for a few days up the Indian Ocean to the east, you'll come to a big bay called San Sebastian Bay. And that's where the southern right whale calves. And it's also an environment that is lush with what we call fynbos in South Africa. And it's kind of like a Mediterranean bushveld environment. And it's that nature reserve is home to an array of bird life and snake life. The largest mammal that you'll probably see on the reserve is called the bontebok. And in Southern Africa, the word bok means deer. So we have gemsbok and a springbok and a bontebok. The bontebok are chocolate brown in color with a white belly and white markings coming down from its eyes and 1.5 curls to its black horns. But growing up, I spent about 6 months of the year living in the bush with my parents, and we lived in a thatch hut. It was an A-frame thatch hut. The thatch was made from the environment. It grows right outside the hut, with this whole concept of blending in with the land and living alongside the animals and the birds and the snakes, living with them, coexisting, being a steward of the land. And so as a child, I learned to take only what you need and to gather from the sea. We'd go out to the tide pools with my dad, and we sometimes would collect octopus, and then later on we decided not to eat octopus anymore, but we would catch that with our bare hands, and my dad would go out to sea, and as time went on, he would have to go farther and farther out to sea as overfishing became a problem. But we would keep an eye out for poachers and just take care of that environment. And so about 6 months of the year I lived there and in the bush, just my parents and I. Clothing was optional. I peed in the bush. Ticks were a daily occurrence. And then juxtaposition. My mother is from Montana. So my mother comes from Valier, Montana, which is right up in north central Montana. And I think she's about fourth generation Montanan. My grandfather was a hunting, packing guide in the Bob Marshall, as well as a farmer. He also sold John Deere tractors. And my mom grew up fly fishing and hunting with her father and having a deep appreciation for the wilderness of Montana, in particular the grizzly bears. And my mom would lay on her back on the shores of Lake Francis, which is there in Valier. And she would look up at the sky, and we're talking the 40s now because my mother was born in 1941. And she would dream of this world outside of Valier, and she embraced that in the early 60s by starting a 40-year career with United Airlines. And so my mother worked with United Airlines as an international flight attendant and supervisor between the years of 1963 and 2004. Okay. And that's why my family was able to travel so much and go back and forth between Africa and Montana and Australia so frequently is because we had these standby plane tickets. And so yes, my childhood was split between the nature reserve in South Africa, growing up in Montana, actually at those periods of time being put into a public school and, you know, not only having to wear clothes and shoes to school now, but also like asking permission to go to the bathroom and all these things that we do in America that were not necessarily something that was done in South Africa. But I learned to fall in love with that juxtaposition of culture and ecosystems and ways of, you know, navigating your environment, be it a wilderness area or a concrete jungle. And Australia is also very near and dear to my heart. I spent a lot of time living for chunks of the year in Australia, mostly Western Australia in my younger years. And then in my teens, I spent a lot of time with Indigenous Aboriginal Australians, sitting with them and learning about how they are custodian of the land and the animals and how they tell their stories. And they use music a lot of the time and dance. And so I started to played the didgeridoo, and that's my way of communicating and connecting with adults and children, and using the didgeridoo as a skeleton key of choice to kind of open the door to communicating, because not everybody speaks English and music is an international language, so it's my favorite way to connect with someone and then dive deep into conservation and travel and culture. And just my intention is to plant these little seeds of curiosity about our world wherever I go with the youngest of humans, you know, and because they're the future. So to answer your question, Africa is in my heart, Montana is in my heart, Australia is in my heart. But the more I travel and kind of expand my vision of what I want to do, I appreciate Missoula, Montana, even more. And that vision I have cultivated is really honing in on what I want to do here in my community and in our rolling plains and prairie and rivers and ecosystems and wildlife. I started interviewing people when I was 14 in China. I wanted to work in China, so I started studying Mandarin and making frequent trips to China with my mom. And, you know, the best way to practice a language is in that country. A lot of the times it's with a taxi driver. So I would travel extensively in China, but I'd say my eyes really opened big when I was floating the Yangtze-Jiang, the Yangtze River, which flows, you know, its headwaters are into the Tibetan Plateau, but it is now, you know, controlled by a dam in Yichang, China, which is called the Three Gorges Dam. And so I traveled to China in my teens, often. In one of the trips in particular, my mother and I floated the Yangtze-Jiang during the period of when they were relocating citizens and, wow, you know, tearing down buildings so that the whole gorge area could be flooded for the largest hydroelectric power station in the world, at least at the time. And so I started to interview Chinese citizens, practicing my Mandarin and...
How old were you again?
14 okay. or so. And so I would ask them, you know, how do you feel about being relocated, you know, from these farms that you have been at for 5,000 years? And that really opened my eyes to a couple things. And one of those was that the camera was a block between me and that person that I was interviewing. You know, it was like this barrier to really connect with them. So that's when I went more towards audio and started a radio show when I was 18. And that the roots of that are all built upon storytelling and music. And at age 18, I also discovered that you could get paid to guide whitewater. So that was a 15-year journey where I guided over 250 days of the year, particularly starting when I graduated from the University of Montana with my degree in marketing and media arts. I went full-on and would be guiding full-time in the Grand Canyon between April and September, and then after that season ended, that's when the New Zealand season started. So then I would guide sea kayaking expeditions in Fiordland National Park, which is on New Zealand's South Island's western coast, or head over to Morocco to guide on the Hansel River in the Middle Atlas Mountains, or in Southern Africa on our Orange River Gorge, which the Orange River marks the boundary line between Namibia and South Africa. It slices through the Southern Kalahari and Namib deserts. And the reason I spent so much of my time and my physical energy, my body, my essence guiding, because it's a lot, you know, to be out there. You're on the clock 24/7, you know, and some situations you're taking these people through some of the biggest whitewater in the world, and they maybe don't know how to swim or whatever it is. So it takes a lot of you to, you know, to put yourself there fully present. But the reason I did that is because I truly believe that the people who spend more time in these wild places are more likely to walk away and fight to protect them. You know, when you see that when you take people down the Grand Canyon for 15 days at a time, and they suddenly evolve into this beautiful conservationist who is vigilant and pays attention and becomes a member of organizations who are fighting to make a difference. So, you know, I think that for me, guiding was a huge part in empowering people to believe in themselves and that they can do what they think they can't do, because that's pretty fulfilling when you see someone overcome a fear and then have more belief in themselves. That's beautiful. But also remembering why we're fighting to protect these places and what's out there and how special it is. So a little bit about myself. Missoula's my home. I've had a taste of the world, and that's important to me, to stay connected with what's going on worldwide. And I just don't see myself at a stage now where I need to be living for months on end in a utility closet in the middle of Marrakesh, you know, living on a $7 a day budget. You know, like that's an old chapter that's closing. And now I'm really rooting myself down into Missoula and going to the farmer's market and getting a dog and being a part of community, because the truth is you can travel your whole life, but if you don't have a community, it can be kind of lonely towards the end there. So I hope that answers your question.
It's beautiful. Yeah, thank you. So I'm curious about a couple of things. I get this is the part of the podcast where I always struggle to pick which question I want to go with first. but I think I want to start with the core value, because I think anybody who works in a field that they believe in and works to preserve something that's important to them, you have to have this value or this reason to come back to for your mental health and for the longevity of the work that you do, to remind yourself of why you're doing it and why it's important. And I think for me, it's always been most effective if I can narrow that down very specifically. I mean, it doesn't have to be, it can be very broad and specific at the same time, but I'm curious what that is for you in the conservation work that you're doing with us, but also in the conservation work that you've done on the river, and your connection to the natural world. Like, what is the core value there that continues to drive you?
It's that we have one planet, you know, like, to think that there's another option, at least for this generation, or, you know, our friends and family's grandchildren, that they have another planet that they can go to. It's nice that we have that technology, but why, I feel like it's not too late. I sincerely feel like hope is what it's all about, especially with, be it an issue regarding, you know, South Africa trying to heal from the apartheid era, or the world trying to recover from what we've been doing for the past 200 years. And to really wake up, open your eyes, and notice that cause and effect is real, and that we can actually change our behavior and teach the next generation how to change their behavior, and to and that we actually might see those effects moving forward. What first popped into my mind when you said that is just getting out there and actually getting your hands on it and getting your hands dirty. You know, Marsha and I were able to go and help with a beaver restoration project 2 weeks ago, and for me that kind of recharges my battery. You know, it's like getting out there in the field, getting your hands dirty, and just remembering at the end of the day what you're fighting to protect. But about 10 years ago, I was part of what was called the Oily River Rendezvous. And so it was a year that the Yellowstone River and many of the rivers in Montana were above flood stage. And ExxonMobil spilled over 42,000 gallons of oil in the Yellowstone River. And we're not going to clean it up past a certain point, right around the Billings area, I believe. And so my mentor, Gary Steele, and my partner Wesley, we paddled from where the cleanup effort stopped to basically until we didn't find any more signs of oil. So we paddled until there were no more bathtub rings, till there were no more oily set, unfortunately, until there were no more dead animals in the swamps covered in oil, until the signs were gone. And I think we paddled over 80 miles, and we documented along the way and communicated with the Billings Gazette about what we were finding. But that was just pretty powerful to see what only three people, you know, could do, and that it might at the end of the day help with the continued effort of that oil spill. And so one of my favorite African proverbs is, if you think you're too small or too little to make a difference, obviously you've not spent the night with a mosquito or something like that. So I just think that, you know, long-winded way to answer that question, hope that we can truly make a difference, and that it's not too late. It's just when we start to nonchalantly, you know, continue using plastic garbage bags and forget to recycle our aluminum, you know, that's like a slippery slope into just not really being mindful at all about your waste. So I think I'm going to wrap it up there.
Okay. Beautiful. Okay. Another question I had was, because I believe that guides and you alluded to this when you were talking about being a river guide, that oftentimes they are the best ambassadors for the natural world because they are able to connect with people in very unique ways on in the natural world. And so I'm curious, in your experience, both what do you find most powerful about their aha moments that they have when they're in that environment with you, but then also I'm curious about ways to inspire an aha moment. That's the educator in me. I want to know how you get the aha moment.
Yeah. As a guide, you know, for most of my time recently has been spent in the Grand Canyon, but we sleep on our rafts. And so in the morning, I wake up and I sit up and I'm on my raft and I look at shore and I look at everybody and I try to connect with them and think of how can I make their day today? You know, like how can they connect with themselves and this environment? And so everybody has a different way of learning. Everybody has a different way of communicating and everybody has a different way of connecting. And so one thing that comes to mind was a guest who went down the river with me last year. Her name was Bodhi. Her name was Linda Bodhi. Unfortunately, she recently passed away of cancer, but she in private told me that she had a fear of snakes and she really wanted to get over that fear of snakes. And she didn't want anybody else to know that she was going through it because it was pretty traumatic, the fear she was working through. And so with that in mind, her and I were able to spend some time at a safe distance with the Grand Canyon pink, which is an endemic species of rattlesnake, only found in Grand Canyon. It's pink in color. They're very chill. They're very relaxed. You're honored if you get to even see one. Oftentimes the Grand Canyon pink will give you a buzz and then immediately move away from where it made that sound to attract the predator to where the sound came from. But a lot of the times you'll walk right past them and you won't even know they're there. They're big chillers. But she was able to connect with that snake. We didn't hold it. We didn't do anything. We just sat in its presence. And she was able to heal through some of that trauma that she was storing inside and walk away with a deeper connection to that creature and to that environment that creature spent its time in. And we were able to later on connect and she reached out to me towards the end of her life and told me how powerful that was. And it's kind of hard to talk about. You get that little choke up in your throat when you're talking about things like this. But, you know, I had no idea that it was that powerful for her to do that, you know. Mm-hmm. You can never underestimate someone's experience and what it means to them. Mm-hmm. And for me, I'm very protective when it comes to a child's experience in any environment. But with my field, it's whitewater. And so the goal is to have fun and to not freeze to death or, you know, be starving or, worst case scenario, fall out of the raft and have a swim. You know, because then often people will carry those experiences later on into their life. So I just like to have that that experience on the river or in the mountains or wherever it is that you are, the desert, be a positive one and find out how they connect. And to incorporate that in your way of interacting with them, you know, and to honor that some people are shy and some people are introverts, some people are extroverts, some people prefer the company of animals more than humans. I'm one of them. But, you know, like just connecting with people in the way that they see the world and also really encouraging people to get away from their screens and disconnect. I do a program with my mentor, Gary. It's called Getting Primitive, and the idea is moving back in order to move forward. So getting kids outside, away from computers, running around in the woods. We teach them how to use primitive weapons like atlatl, longbow, tomahawks, throwing knives, teach them how to make a bow drill fire. I teach them how to play didgeridoo, and we sit in the teepee and we tell stories. But for me, those are always aha moments after those experiences play out. And you just observe the change in that person. And maybe you don't even really have to do anything. You just facilitate an environment where they can unplug and sit among the wildflowers and notice the little things for once. Kind of go from this macro view of the cell phone screen to the micro view of this beautiful world that we live in.
I often answer your questions and completely forgot what the question was in the beginning. I wonder if my guests do this now when I'm thinking back on my radio show. But I hope that answers your question because I forget what the original...
Yeah, no, it answers it beautifully. Yeah, and I think it's... I appreciate that perspective for so many different reasons, but I think, thinking specifically about Artemis when we're talking to people about hunting or fishing or conservation, mm-hmm. That's something that's important to me as well, is helping people approach it. I talk a lot, especially in our advocacy trainings, or even in hunting and fishing, that we all come to the table with preconceived notions about what it means to do something or be something.
Yeah.
And that we just need to do away with all of those preconceived ideas and figure out what it means for us. And I think you're taking the teacher's perspective of that, where you're figuring out how you can help them figure out what it means to them. That's a convoluted sentence, but I appreciate that perspective. And I hope that when people bring people into the field as mentors, mm-hmm. that they're taking the same approach. It's not necessarily about what you need to teach them, and it's not necessarily about how you want to teach. It's about the person's experience and how they want to approach it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a bumblebee. It was a big, beautiful bumblebee. I am curious, can you tell me about your background as an angler?
Yeah. So... going back to South Africa, to my earliest memories, maybe I can give you a photograph of me to use.
Yes.
I'm thinking about this one particular picture where I'm holding a fish in one hand. We used to call them the Red Roman. I'm not sure that it was like the English translation, but I'm holding a fish in one hand and a shark in the other, which is really curious because now I am fully infatuated by sharks. And spend quite a lot of time bringing awareness to, shark conservation, particularly great white sharks, and the fact that humans kill about 100 million sharks a year, and not a lot of humans realize that sharks kill an average of like 3 to 4 humans a year. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to go on that tangent unless you want me to go there, but like, there's this photo of me holding a fish in one hand and a shark in the other, and I'm sure we did end up eating the shark. But I would go fishing with my dad out in the ocean when I was big enough. When I was too small, I would had to sit on the beach because there was a fear that like some of the fish that we were going to be hooking out there were big enough to actually pull me into the ocean, you right. know, because I was so small. So I remember there was a time where I was sitting on the beach in South Africa and I had the whole harness strapped on myself with the rod in this like cup on my chest. And it was like, I wanted to prove that I was big enough to be able to go out onto the boat, that I wouldn't just get pulled in. And I remember I did hook something right there on the Indian Ocean. I don't remember what it was, but it almost pulled me into the surf. You know, I still wasn't big enough to go out there. But that was a lot of my experiences. It was just, you know, spending time on the ocean fishing with my dad, and then let's go ahead and juxtapose to all the fishing that we did in Montana, because don't tell anyone, but there's some fishing that we done here. And so a lot of lure fishing when I was a kid, and we would go to East Rosebud Lake, which is right in the Beartooth Mountain Range outside of Billings, Montana, and there was a cabin that we would go to almost every weekend, and in the wintertime we would snowshoe in. And we would cut a hole in the lake and fish. So we would fish there year round.
Cool.
And my dad loves telling the story. I'm sure he's visiting me this weekend. He'll probably tell it again about, I would just say, Dad, I can feel the fish. I can feel them tickling, you know, when they were just about to bite. And, apparently during one fishing trip, this young man said that I wouldn't catch any fish because I was a girl. And I don't totally remember that, but apparently I caught like 12 or so that day and he didn't catch any. And every time he looked over, I'd pull my line of fish out of the water. And I don't remember that, but my dad loves telling that story. And so enjoying being out, being quiet, fishing with my dad in Montana, fishing with my mom as well. My mom is a fly fisherman. So on my mom's side, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, my mother, all fly fishermen. My mother still cries when she sees the movie A River Runs Through It. Because at the end, when they're quoting Norman MacLean, and you see the old man's hands tying a fly, my mom says that that's my grandfather's hands. Mm. And so my mom, I've inherited my mom's entire kit and quiver of rods. My mom's fly fished all over the world. One of her favorite places to go fly fishing was in Tasmania. And she'd often get completely lost in the forest down there and lose all track of time. And so I think that I've kind of going into it, inherited that from my parents, like just a love of being out there, not necessarily catching anything, but just standing in the water, being quiet, and losing all track of time. And then, you know, heading back home when it felt right. Maybe got dark and you slept there on the side of the river, you know. Now I'm just absolutely love going fly fishing. Won't go into great detail about where I've been fishing recently, but I've been going out with friends and looking for the browns and the rainbows in the shadows, and working on casting with a streamer.
Bear. Wow. Sorry, there's a black bear walking across probably 100 yards from us. Oh, he's beautiful. Can you take a picture of him? Do you have your phone?
Wow. That's auspicious.
Yeah, it is.
Artemis.
Oh, look at him. Gorgeous. Look at that coloring. He's like mostly a black bear, but oop, he can hear me. Has a light brown ring around his waist and again around his bottom, like he's wearing diapers. It's gorgeous. He just disappeared into the trees. That was really beautiful.
That's amazing.
you could see the trees moving as he's like, I don't know if he's still walking or if he's pulling them down. That's, oh, wow.
That's suspicious for your first.
Well, and I don't know if you're a regular listener to the podcast, but I have a fascination with bears. Mm-hmm. They're one of my favorite animals. So it's that was lovely. Yeah.
A medicine man told me that when you see a bear or experience bear energy, that's a sign of like time for rest, time for hibernation.
I think we both need to listen to that, Mandela.
Yes. Yeah. Hibernating.
Yep. Moving slowly and with purpose.
Like that beautiful bear just did.
Yep.
He or she is over there, I think, just hanging out. We're probably going to see him again in a moment.
Nice.
That makes me have a really good feeling about my game camera, too. Set up just, I'm sure, on that same trail. Wow.
Very cool. I don't remember what we were talking about. you were talking about fishing.
Yeah,
and getting lost in the river.
Yeah.
Spending the night on the banks.
When I think about fishing, I just think about the way that we lived. We depended on the sea. We didn't have a refrigerator. Yeah, it was propane. It was a propane fridge. It was like a car fridge. So we didn't really use it that much. When we went to the nature reserve, we would have lots of powdered milk and canned food and lentils and things that could keep for months on end because we wouldn't go to town. We would be out in the bush for months. And so the fresh produce came from the sea. And so when I think about fishing, I still think about being on the nature reserve. My dad had a rubber ducky which is what we call it in South Africa. I think it's a zodiac, I think they call it in America. It's like a raft with a wooden bottom. Ours did. Ours had a wooden bottom and an engine off the back. And my dad going out to sea and coming back with our dinner. And he fished every day. And out in front of the hut where I grew up, there's a little lagoon. And he would go out there and cast a net. And when I think about my dad and when I think about fishing, I think about my dad throwing the net out and capturing probably some kind of species of whitefish to use as bait to catch the bigger species out at sea. Mm-hmm. I think about the stories that my dad told me when he came back from fishing out at sea. You know, one in particular was being out there in the boat, which the boat itself was probably 12 feet long or so. And he says that the sharks would always come out there, you know, when they're fishing. And one time he and his friend were fishing out at sea, and there was two sharks swimming around the boat. And it took him a few minutes to realize that that was not two sharks, because the front dorsal fin was staying steady and the rear dorsal fin was actually moving back and forth. So that was actually the tail fin. So here they thought it was two sharks, but it was actually like
one
20-foot shark that was circling their boat. And they got out of there real fast. But other days he said that there were dolphins as far as the eye could see in every direction. But he always came back with fresh fish. And I had my favorite fish. It was called Red Roman growing up. I can send you a picture of me holding one. And we would always cook those on the open fire. There was a little table set out right in front of the hut where he would get out of the boat and, you know, clean the fish right there. And then my mom had gotten the fire ready and probably baked some bread in the Dutch oven. And then we would cook the fish on the open fire, and always eating in the dark because we'd never had coals. Yeah, coals. We didn't have coals and liquid petrol that you would put on the coals. We would build a fire with driftwood. Mm-hmm. And so you'd have to wait hours before the driftwood was perfect temperature and consistency mm-hmm. to cook a fish on the fire. And we did that in South Africa. We did that in Montana, cooking a trout on the fire. That's how my parents met. You know, they both came from farming backgrounds, but they are both fishermen. My mom was a fly fisherman and my dad was an ocean fisherman. So mm-hmm. I think that's how they connected.
It's like... What is that? The River Wye? Have you read The River Wye?
Mm-mm.
I need to give that to you.
Okay.
Yeah.
I look forward to reading it.
Okay.
I mean, I've just always been fascinated by the way that people gather from the sea all over the world and from the land as well. But it's just pretty phenomenal the different ways that these diverse cultures worldwide cultivate and harvest fish. I mean, what comes to mind right now, too, is the ancient, archaic wooden fishing vessels that would head out into the Bay of Bengal and the Indian Ocean when I was living. I lived in a fishing village in India for a number of months called Kovalam. And the whole entire village surrounded the fishing, you know. And going out early in the morning, and I connected with a man he was a fourth generation fisherman, and he talked about the changes he's noticed in his fishing seasons because of climate change. And it's like, gosh, I want to connect Aaron with this guy, but the only way we can, you know, because we do this beautiful podcast as well called National Wildlife Federation Outdoors Vanishing Seasons. And so you talk to fishermen and hunters about these effects you've seen in climate change. And so this is one of these interviews I did in India with this man, but there's no way you can contact him. I know where he sits,
yeah.
You know, by the fishing boats. But you'd have to like travel there to see him. And, you know, he and sometimes they would actually wade out into the ocean, and they would hold the reel in their hand, you know, and they had the. Every culture has this beautiful way of reading their environment and learning how to get those fish on the dinner table. But worldwide, I'd say everybody's noticed that there's not as much. You have to go farther out. Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things, just hearing you talk about your youth, but also your experience traveling around the world, is there's just this, I sense it in myself sometimes, and I see it in other people as well, where we're so used to a certain level of comfort that we have a hard time just sitting on the edge of a river and having dinner and being in that moment without thinking about when we're going to move on. And I think I see that in you still when you talk about your Land Rover and the adventures you have in that already, and just the comfort of being present wherever you are, and functioning in that environment. I don't know if that makes sense, but like, eat where you are, sleep where you are, yeah. Connect where you are. And I find that refreshing. I find that very refreshing.
I encourage everybody to do that. You know, if you really want to connect with a place to spend 24 hours there, just for starts. Mm-hmm. And then maybe a couple days, and then maybe a week. I mean, we don't all have that much time to play with in our culture. We don't have, you know, necessarily a whole week to spend in a wild place. But for example, we're in the forest right now, and this is a place where I've been scheming and dreaming for about 6 years to try to build a little home for my mom. And the ideas and the connection that has been born from sleeping out here is can't put a price on it. I recommend that you connect with the land as deeply as you possibly can. And if it's sleeping out there, if it's, you know, spending time in the forest, staring out, waiting for an animal to come by that you might harvest and feed your family with, and maybe not, but you're still spending time and connecting with that environment, you know, or being on the edge of a river or a lake, be it frozen or thawed. And I also, coming back to yoga, just not having any attachment to the outcome, you know. Can I talk about yoga? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So in the Yoga Sutras written by Patanjali about 2000 years ago, it says, "Yoga's chitta vritti nirodha," which is Sanskrit for "yoga is the cessation of the fluctuations of the mind." And I truly believe that you can find that in many areas of your life. It does not have to be wearing these tight clothes, sitting on a mat, doing these postures. That is not yoga. I mean, that's one of the branches of yoga, but, you know, maybe it's martial arts, maybe it's painting, maybe it's walking in the woods with your rifle, maybe it's, you know, fishing on the side of a river, maybe it's sitting in meditation. But when you can really cease the wandering mind and really be where you are in that moment entirely, it's a beautiful way to navigate this world. And we're all working on it. You know, it's just, we have our good days and I wouldn't say bad days, but the days where we're observing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes on my bad days where I don't find myself present, I try to maybe just imagine being an observer, you know, like being on the other side of the river, observing me in the way that I'm deciding to navigate the world that day. Because you create your own reality, right? Like, you go out there and, you know, a few years ago on the river, I encountered 12 rattlesnakes in one season, and two of them were underneath my personal belongings. Like, one of them was underneath my bag at camp, and I found it while I was looking for my head torch at night, and it buzzed me and then crawled across my sleeping bag bed and into the darkness of the night. And then the second time, it crawled out from underneath my clothes while I was taking a bath in the river. And I could have, you know, gone through my day being super paranoid that there were going to be snakes everywhere. But the truth is that you're so lucky if you're able to encounter a snake on your journey, and yeah, you're able to be sitting in the forest with a friend and all of a sudden a bear pops up. I mean, that's coming back to what drives me, is that we still live in a world where that just happened to us,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
or that a snake can decide that my backpack is a good place to rest for a moment. You know, you create your own reality. Remember that. And, it's a constant practice, you know. Patanjali also wrote that there's two pillars of yoga, abhyasa and vairagya. Abhyasa means practice. It can also be defined as repetition, you know, like you repeat. You want to, you know, what is your practice? You keep repeating it. And then non-attachment. Vairagya is non-attachment. And I like to remind my students to have non-attachment to the practice. You know? Mm-hmm. So.
I have two somewhat smaller questions. I feel like we've been talking about very big questions, which is really, really fun and what I enjoy a lot. I have two smaller questions, and one is I'm curious with this career change and this delving into the sporting world for a month, right? It's been a month since you started with us. Mm-hmm. What's been surprising or what's been interesting? What's caught your attention? Maybe that's not a small question, sorry.
That's a very good question. I would say the passion and the connection that the sporting community has with the land and the animals, and how accessible that is for people who have not yet cultivated a love of, be it hunting or be it fishing, and that accessibility can be provided by simply inviting someone out to go fishing for the day, go out boating. You know, this week is National Fishing and Boating Week, y'all. And I read a study that said most people who don't fish, it's simply because no one's ever invited them to go out doing it. Mm-hmm. And so I would just say that I've just, I wasn't surprised, but I've been inspired by the passion of the hunters and the anglers that I've been able to spend time with recently, and how open they are to sharing what they know with those who are curious. Mm-hmm. And I also think it's worth noting that hunters and anglers are like the original conservationists. And I don't know if a lot of people realize how much funding for conservation has actually come from the money that's spent on buying licenses and special taxes on gear. And so there's a lot of beauty to that, and there's a lot of connection to the land and the animal as well.
I do feel though that that's a good segue into my next question, which is, what is your what's on your bucket list to learn next when it comes to being an outdoors person and a naturalist? And
well, I think it's very important to find a good mentor, and that has been just part of my journey from the very beginning. And recently I've met a few potential mentors. One of them is very busy. She's about to move to Washington, D.C. and lead the BLM. So I'm referring to Tracy Stone Manning. I was very honored to spend a few hours walking in this forest with her about a week ago. But another person is sitting with me here today, Marcia, and I'm just so grateful that we live in the same town, and I'm really looking forward to learning from you. And then the other evening, we were able to sit with Jesse from the Wyoming Wildlife Federation, and it's almost like I put the energy out there, starting with the day that you and I went and did the beaver restoration work, about how much I'd like to cultivate. Or it was up there in the forest, actually, when I told you that I would like to sit patiently in the woods with a longbow, traditional style, and maybe an animal comes around, maybe it doesn't, but to have my grouping close enough where I could get a kill shot and harvest for my family using a bow and arrow. And I'm open also to rifles. You know, my partner has, he's an avid hunter, and I go to hunting camp with him every year. We do a whitetail camp and an elk camp, and my favorite part is the harvest. I love quartering the animal and getting it out there and walking around in the forest. But I really do feel a draw to sitting quietly, like the Shoshone Bannock on the edge of the Middle Fork of the Salmon River, where I guided. The Shoshone Bannock would make bows out of the horn of a bighorn sheep. They would take the horn and they would soak it in the naturally occurring hot springs there on the Middle Fork of the Salmon, wait for it to soften, and they would stretch the horn out and make a tiny little bow. And then they would sit quietly. And we were talking like patience. We're talking maybe a multiple days of waiting until the right animal came along. And it wouldn't necessarily be the healthiest, biggest one. It was maybe the sick one or maybe an older one. And I really appreciate that patience and that mindfulness when deciding to be it, pull the trigger, or to let go of the arrow. And that is something that I am looking very much forward to, spending time with mentors such as yourself, Marcia, and Jesse. Jesse, after I kind of started to put that energy out there that I wanted to learn, she recommended what bow I might want to start with. Because I do shoot a bow and arrow, but it's usually at a target that's made out of cardboard and it looks like a mastodon, because that's what we use for the kids, you know. But to actually start to get serious about it, and then maybe go down to Wyoming in September and consider hunting elk and maybe even the pronghorn. But kind of like the earth being our oyster, and my list of places I want to explore and experience getting longer and longer, the ways that in which I want to experience the realm of connection via hunting and fishing is pretty extensive. Mm-hmm. Because the way that hunting is seen and followed through in other countries is also quite admirable. Like, for example, hunters in the Amazon who do like heavy drugs and go hunting for like 48 hours or 72 hours at a time. Like, I'm talking about heavy drugs. I'm talking about yerba mate, that mm-hmm. which we drink in America, you know, to help focus and all that. But that was actually originated because of hunting, you know, to be able to stay caffeinated during the hunt for days at a time. And so I'm so fascinated by it. Like, maybe one day taking my arrow tip and maybe rubbing it on the back of a little frog, and of course sending him on his way and not bothering him too much, just borrowing a little bit of that poison. But yeah, I don't know, I think it's just so fascinating, no matter where you are in the world, how people have learned to live with the land and the animals and only taking what they need. So
fantastic. Well, that's my bucket list includes traditional bow hunting as well, so that's something we can learn together, and that will be fun.
Yes.
Yeah,
look forward to it. Wonderful.
This was a wonderful conversation. Thank you.
Yeah.
It took us to unexpected places, and we had unexpected guest stars, and it was wonderful.
I mean, I've been doing this for like 15 or so years, you know, like sitting in interview, and I'm not, this is the first time in a very, very long time where I've been the one being interviewed, but sitting and, you know, like doing an interview, and it feels different. I feel relaxed and just so inspired by this environment. But I'll tell you, I never had a bear walk into the picture while recording.
Right.
That's just so wonderful. He just painted the picture of, you know, what he looked like and him wandering off. I think he's still sitting up there somewhere.
Nice. Yeah, I haven't seen the trees move to indicate that he's gone his own way.
It's about time for a nap anyways.
Isn't it? And that looks like a lovely place. All right. That brings us to our weekly closer, hits and misses. What have you been aiming for and how did it go?
When I considered that question earlier, the one thing that came to mind was a dream of mine that I was able to consider, experiment with, and then follow through. And I say it that way because I try not to like go into things with like this set goal. Mm-hmm. 'Cause then the unmet expectations, some say, are the root of all suffering. So this, what I'm talking about is swimming the Grand Canyon with a boogie board. And that got stuck in my head when I was 17 years old, that I would do that one day. And it was because I was canoeing the Alberton Gorge with a man who was a champion canoer. At around 38,000 CFS. So that's not recommended, by the way. Yeah. But if you're going to do it with professionals. And that day we were doing a swiftwater rescue training. It was my very first swiftwater rescue training. And I remember I was the only one who volunteered to canoe with Alan that day. And when we got to the tightest section of the gorge, he told me we were going to flip. And I said, no, don't be positive. We're not going to flip. And sure enough, we did an ender. We flipped the bow of our stern. And I remember how much I enjoyed being in the river and feeling the currents and how calm I felt in that water, and was really enjoying the experience up until when I got rescued. I was like, no, I have no worries, mate. But yeah, I was rescued by this river board. So a river board is like a big boogie board with four handles, and it's designed for river rescue, life bait rescue. And I got pretty hooked on swimming the rivers as much as I possibly could with the aid of a river board. And I knew that one day I would attempt to swim the entire Grand Canyon with one. And that opportunity came in February of 2020, just before the pandemic. I had come over from South Africa right when the first COVID-19 case arrived via Nigeria. And it was kind of like, this is going on in the background, but here we are. We're going to go in the Grand Canyon now and be present for 15 days. And I went into it thinking that it would be akin to a moving meditation. My biggest fear was that I would fall behind and hold everybody else up. But swimming in the river, the thawag is a really fun word, by the way, for those who maybe don't know. Thalweg. So it's like the fastest current in the river, and it's about 4.5 feet below the surface. And so when you fall out of a raft or you're swimming via use of a riverboard, you're going to be actually faster than the raft because you're in the thawag. So by utilizing the thawag, I was able to stay out in front. I wore a dry suit and about 10 layers of really itchy wool, half of which I purchased the night before the expedition because I saw that it was supposed to be snowing when we started. But I thought, okay, let's just see how the first 2 days go, and then we'll readjust, and maybe I'll decide after that if I want to spend another 13 days swimming in the Colorado. And it was an incredibly beautiful experience. I'd say the most challenging part of it was the flat water, because the Colorado River that runs through Grand Canyon is actually mostly flat water. A lot of the vertical drop is made up of the white water. I'd say the majority is, but there is quite a lot of flat water, almost lake-like flat water. And it was just an amazing way to once again connect with the river. That was my intention, was to have a deeper connection with the currents below the surface. I'd been spending so much time above the surface, you know, over half the year in a raft, but what's it like below the surface? What's it like for the fish down there? We're talking about, you know, the way that the current would change as we approached a horizon line, to the way the current behaved within the rapids themselves, to, you know, floating below the little Colorado River and actually having a humpback chub nibble on, you know, on my finger while I'm swimming in the water. It was a beautiful way to connect. And the whole swim lasted about 15 days, and I was with a training trip so that I did have access to modern technology. You know, I didn't have to carry my own poop out, and I had access to really good food and clothes, which is good because I was eating like high school again. You know, 3 plates of food a day, but I still lost about 15 pounds just because my body was fighting to stay warm and I was kicking all day long. But it was a beautiful way to connect, and I feel a completely different energy now after swimming that river. And so that is the first thing that comes to mind. Just it was a dream for over a decade. I want to remind people that you may have these dreams that are filed away, but you know, life's short, and the hardest part is showing up, be it with yoga or to your dreams. You know, sounds kind of corny, but it's true, right? You go into your dream closet and dust off some of those ones that you filed away, and you know, buy that ticket to whatever country it is that you've been wanting to go to, especially since travel's starting to open up now. And and when you go there, also I'd recommend that you look into ways that you can give back when you're there. You know, there's There's organizations that have actually lists of supplies that those countries need that you can actually bring with you and can really help when you go, so that you're not just taking, but learn to hunt, or you know, I'm not sure if I totally recommend swimming the Grand Canyon. I mean, it was you know, I wrote an article about it in the end. I kind of joked like I'd recommend kayaking, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm glad I did it, and the pictures in the article are pretty fun. I'm just completely completely consumed by brown water mm-hmm. most of the time. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is that my dry suit was broken for the majority of that trip, so I was actually wet for most of it.
Wet and cold,
yeah. But builds character. I mean, it's like, I think it's important to get uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's important to get uncomfortable, you know?
Growth doesn't happen when you're comfortable.
Yep. To add on to the fishing thing, there was something I was going to say, I forget, but I wanted to say that my mother and I would go fishing in De Poyer, which like is up on the north central part of Montana. And there were places that we would go fishing up there where I couldn't even let my fly be on the water for 2 seconds before another fish would jump and bite. And so, you know, that is a major part of the way that I bonded with my parents. And I'm really excited to be able to get back into it again now, because as a guide, I was always the person rowing, you know, mm-hmm. like rowing the dory or the raft to make sure that we stay on the eddy line where the eddy hogs are going to be, where my client can catch a fish. But just the other day was one of the first times where I went out and I was like, I don't have to row all day. Like my friends we're going to take turns, you know, cause I'm not just the guide, you know, I get to actually fish as well. So I'm really excited about that, you know, getting back into, not necessarily helping someone else to go fishing, but to go fishing myself too, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Well, we should go sometime.
That sounds good.
All right. That's amazing. Yeah, my hit and miss is a little, I don't know how to, I'm trying to pick the right adjective for it. A little bit more recent, mm-hmm. a little bit smaller, but as I mentioned, my sister and her family were visiting, and, I have two nephews, one who's 9 and one who's 12, and the 12-year-old is, really interested in fishing. So he was able to go on the Missouri on a guided trip while he was here and catch some fish. And that was amazing. Saw some big smiles. They were open to trying some wild game. So I made some antelope for them, some sweet and sour antelope meatballs. And then I also made some bear for them. I did some barbacoa bear tacos, which was a shoulder roast, a bone-in shoulder roast that was slow cooked. And they devoured it. They devoured them both and really loved it. And that was exciting to me because I think that was the first time that they'd ever tried game. And I went all in, right? I didn't say, here's some venison, let's have some burgers. Like, we had antelope and we had bear, and they loved it. And so that was exciting. And now my oldest nephew is coming out in November to go out east with us to go antelope and mule deer hunting. So excited.
Awesome.
Yeah. It kind of just harkening back to what we were talking about. It's taking somebody's desire to connect with nature in a new way and really just fanning those flames and loving to see what comes from it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was at a fishing camp about 3 weeks ago up at Missionary Way, and one of the retired fishing guides said to me with a little bit of tears in his eyes that there's nothing that compares to a child catching their first fish in his boat.
Yeah. Oh, I bet. And this sweet nephew is very reserved, and his smiles are only for special occasions. And to see that big smile break out on his face, yeah, lovely.
So kind of going back to the history of fishing in my life, there was a period of time where I was experimenting with not eating any meat and not eating any dairy and kind of just being as simple as I possibly could, kind of just nuts and dried fruit and, you know, lentils and all that kind of stuff, just kind of what I could grow myself, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was, at that point also, this was, I think, about 7 years ago, I got dropped off on an isolated island off the coast of Panama. And to get to that island, it took 3 buses, riding on the back of a pickup truck, and a punga, which is like this little little boat with an engine on the back. And I got dropped off with a bag of rice and a bag of beans and my recording equipment, mm-hmm. with the intention of recording stories and mainly the sound effects of the eventide egg-laying vertebrates and invertebrates. But I started to really connect with this idea of swimming out there in the surf with a spear gun. And I just had to listen to my instincts. My body wanted to eat the fish.
Yeah.
And I think that we all, if we really tune in and listen to what our body's asking us to eat, then we'll find that balance, you know? So I listened to my instincts and I decided to pull the trigger and speared a fish right off that island after interviewing fishermen about all the sharks that are out there. And then of course the sharks come in, you know, spearfishing is, you want to have a shark encounter. That's a great way to have a shark encounter. They'll come in from all directions and, mainly tiger sharks, but got to shore, cooked that fish in hot oil with some salt and then a fresh green naranja, is it orange off the tree. And I can tell you, protein never tasted so good. And so what it taught me was to listen to my body. I just felt a total change in my system after feeding myself that protein. And also that connection to what it took for me to go out there, swim out there with the spear gun, my one shot, take my one shot, get it back to shore while it's bleeding with all, you know, the sharks.
Tiger sharks, yeah.
And then getting to shore, taking the time to prepare it, and then, my goodness, enjoying it there on the beach. With a coconut on the side. I mean, that to this day is one of my best meals I've ever had. And what I learned from that was just trusting my instincts, listening to my body. It will tell me what I need. And that food tastes extra good when you work for it.
It's so true. So true. Oh, this is wonderful. Thank you. Here's to many more conversations.
Cheers
to many more conversations from this very spot.
Yes.
And hopefully another sighting of our bear friend.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you to everybody who joined us this week for the Artemis podcast. Be bold, stay curious, and get outside.